This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. President Trump is in London for the 70th anniversary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. He and French President Emmanuel Macron just wrapped up a joint press conference, and it was a far cry from the bromance they shared once upon a time. Here's President Macron responding to President Trump's comments on ISIS and terrorism.
Let's be serious. The very large number of fighters you have on the ground are ISIS fighters coming from Syria, from Iraq, and the region. It is true that you have foreign fighters coming from Europe, but this is a tiny minority of the overall problem we have in the region. And I think number one priority, because it's not yet finished, is to get rid of ISIS and these terrorist groups. This is our number one priority.
Terrorism is on the minds of a lot of leaders at NATO. The summit is happening just days after a terror attack on London Bridge left two people dead and three more wounded. ISIS has claimed responsibility. What does this attack tell us about the war on terror? And what does NATO's future look like? Let's discuss it with NPR's Frank Langfitt, who joins us from London. Frank, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Joshua.
Also with us in studio is Matthew Levitt, a senior fellow and director at the Reinhard Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Matthew, welcome back to 1A.
Pleasure to be here, Josh. Thanks.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts, so email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Frank, let me start with you, particularly with this joint press conference between President Trump and President Macron. The bromance, I think we can safely say, is over. It got
very
pretty
over.
Spicy pretty quickly.
It wasn't. But you know what I kind of liked about it, Joshua, is there was no pretense. You go to a lot of these sorts of events and people paper over all the differences. Emmanuel Macron was not about to do that for a second. And so he was very direct. And what actually what prompted the exchange that you just played for people was President Trump, as he often does, talking about how he feels the United States has to bear too great a burden, whether it's financial, the amount of money that it puts into defense and supporting NATO or dealing with ISIS. And he was basically saying to Macron, why don't you take back some of these fighters of yours who are in Syria? And Macron's answer was, you know, you're not seeing the big picture here. The big picture is we haven't even defeated ISIS yet. And the implicit criticism there was that the United States has been pulling back too suddenly and not getting the job done. That was clearly part of Macron's message.
Here's a bit of the comment that the president made that led to that response we played just a moment ago.
We have a tremendous amount of captured fighters, ISIS fighters over in Syria. And they're all under lock and key, but many are from France, many are from Germany, many are from UK. They're mostly from Europe, and some of the countries are agreeing. I have not spoken to the president about that. Would you like some nice ISIS fighters?
Yes.
I can give them to you. You can take everyone you want.
Matt Levitt, that comment, first of all, there was the snark at the end toward Emmanuel Macron saying, would you like some ISIS fighters? But there's also this implication in what he said that the ISIS fighters that the U.S. and our allies have caught in Syria are from Europe, that they're from France, they're from Germany, they're from the U.K., kind of saying we are cleaning up your messes yet again.
So it's important to keep the numbers in perspective. We're talking about somewhere around 40,000 foreign fighters that came to join the so-called Islamic State, all told. But the vast majority of them are Syrian, Iraqi, or from other parts of the region. Right now, we believe there are about 2,000 Europeans, all told, that are being held in these camps or perhaps still free. If you think about the UK, for example, British authorities say there are about 900 foreign terrorist fighters from the UK, about 40% of whom have already returned to the UK.
So 2,000 Europeans out of how many again?
Out of about 40,000, upwards of 40,000. The real issue that the Europeans are concerned about, and they expressed this very clearly at the recent counter-Islamic State ministerial meeting that was hosted a week and a half ago here in Washington, D.C., is that because of the president's now twice kind of sudden decisions to either remove all U.S. forces or redeploy U.S. forces from northeast Syria, it's made it much more difficult to deal with those detained foreign fighters and to continue to bring the fight to those who are not yet detained. And so the SDF, the Kurdish-led SDF in northeast Syria, had to take soldiers who were guarding prisons, guarding detention camps, and take them to the front to defend against the Syrian, the Turkish incursion, which was a result of the U.S. redeployment. And so the Europeans are saying, listen, you want to deal with these foreign fighters? Stick to this small, inexpensive, fairly risk-free, and extremely effective deployment that we had in Syria. It's very hard for us Europeans to know how to deploy, how to fund going forward if we don't know if you're going to be there from one Tuesday to the next.
And I took that part of President Macron's comments as well, that when the U.S. pulled out of Syria, Turkish forces swept south. The U.S., Turkey and Syria share a north-south border with Turkey in the north and Syria in the south, and that just kind of allowed them to come into Syria and go after our Kurdish allies. Now, Frank, President Macron recently criticized NATO in a profile in The Economist. President Macron called NATO brain dead, and President Trump brought up that critique during a press conference with Jens Stoltenberg, who is the Secretary General of NATO. Here's part of what he said.
Now, NATO serves a great purpose. It got to be unfair for the United States because the United States was paying a disproportionate amount. And I heard that President Macron said NATO is brain dead. I think that's very insulting.
Frank, what's the context of this, particularly in light of what NATO is, what NATO does, and just the fact that this is a kind of a milestone anniversary for NATO?
I think what Macron is getting at is a big question he was asking even in this press conference not too long ago with President Trump today, is what is NATO's purpose, and particularly what is going on with Turkey and the United States. Here you have two NATO countries, one in the case of Turkey saying it wants to go in and go after these fighters, the United States stepping aside. It's a very, very strange situation to have people in countries in the same military alliance acting in this way. And he's also very concerned about Turkey's role. As we've been reporting over the last number of days, Turkey is saying that unless that NATO defined the fighters that it is against, the ones who've actually been working with the United States in the past to go after ISIS, defines them as terrorists, that in fact Turkey is not going to support any number of policies that might, you know, come out of the summit. And so a lot of what Macron is saying is without what he considers to be strong American leadership, where does this, where does NATO go forward? NATO is effective militarily, but politically, particularly in the last 3 years or so, especially with the United, President Trump attacking members for not spending enough on defense, it's really struggling to figure out what its direction is and exactly what it should be doing.
And Matt, and I think that struggle also has to do with the fact that when NATO was founded in the post-World War II era to try to kind of create this alliance that could deal with that kind of a global threat again, the global threat had to do with nation states, with national actors, as opposed to people who saw a YouTube video or downloaded something on BitTorrent or watched a Discord stream, and then they decide they're going to take up a cause. So NATO is kind of dealing with a world that it literally wasn't designed for.
And NATO would argue that there still are those nation state threats that it needs to contend with, especially from Russia on its eastern borders. And it would argue that especially at the beginning of the Trump administration, when it was made clear to NATO that they had to do more on counterterrorism, that's basically a quote from the president, they did. They created something called NATO South. They created a whole new analytical framework to focus on the Mediterranean, the southern perspective from Europe, focused on migrants and on counterterrorism to specifically fill that gap, fearing that otherwise the president might just pull out of NATO. Here we are after they've made that effort, after they've been providing a lot of support, in particular in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and they're wondering what our commitment is, not just to NATO in general, but to those types of deployments. There is a lot of concern in Europe among our NATO allies that the president's looking to cut and run in Afghanistan, and where will that leave them? NATO is particularly active on the ground in Afghanistan.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit, Matt, in terms of what NATO means to the U.S.? I mean, part of the point of NATO is to create a military alliance, that if someone was attacked, that all of these nations would come to our aid. There's that peace Article 5, which we hear about, that an attack on one is an attack on all. I believe the only nation that's ever invoked Article 5 the United States after the September 11th terror attacks. So we do owe NATO something, but that calculus going forward is exactly what the president's comments about NATO get at. But is it clear what he wants out of NATO other than more money?
Look, the president's sense of, you know, equal equal contributions is something that's been a constant. We know that that's something he wants. Beyond that, I'm not sure exactly if it is clear what he wants. I don't think that the president necessarily sees, for example, our commitment and deployments to Europe as something that we're doing not just as a favor to them, but because that's in our interest, because the alliance is in our interest, because the alliance not only protects Europe and Western democracy, but has been able to go places and step up, whether it's in North Africa and Afghanistan and Iraq, and engage in a coalition, a military coalition that's been able to contribute to international security.
And Frank, how much are the economics of NATO on the president's agenda? Are there other things he's been talking about so far?
He continues to hit on the economics. And, you know, he looks at this very much as the former developer from Queens that he is at his heart, which is he's a very transactional businessman. And I think he sees a lot of money going out, and he doesn't see the kind of return that he expects or wants. And I also don't know that he necessarily seems to appreciate that with the sort of stability that NATO brings, that also means that markets remain safe and they economics remains safe and risk is low, which is always very good for business. And so he doesn't seem to have that appreciation of the sort of stability that NATO brings that actually is very beneficial for the economies of Western Europe as well as the United States economy.
We will continue in a moment with NPR's Frank Langford and Matt Levitt of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, including talking about that attack on London Bridge. Jordan asked, how is two people getting killed anything more than a local news story? This is being sensationalized. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing President Trump's visit to London for the NATO summit and the recent terror attack on London Bridge with NPR's Frank Langford and with Matt Levitt, the senior fellow and director of the Reinhard Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We welcome your questions and thoughts, particularly if you're keeping an eye on this year's summit. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Ray emailed, we have been protecting NATO since World War II, as well as coming to their rescue in two world wars. Our military has provided the bulk of their defense for decades. President Macron should look inward since France abandoned NATO for 50 years in 1966. Talk about hypocrisy. Frank Langford, is that true? Did France abandon NATO for 50 years?
I don't know that it was 50 years, and Matthew could probably answer better. I think there was definitely a period. But just to go further to the point, I mean, Macron and many others in Europe do agree that these countries need to spend more. Certainly Obama made these arguments. Trump has made them much more vociferously, and they are listening. So there's no doubt that most leaders in NATO nations here in Europe agree with the president in principle.
So, Matt, if they agree that they should spend more, why don't they?
Well, part of it, first of all, is the timing, right? They're supposed to be increasing to 2% of defense spending, I believe, by 2024. And so some of the Europeans are saying, so give us till 2024. The president, I think, would like that to happen a lot faster.
Now, I'm sorry, pause on that. Explain that 2%, because that gets kicked around a lot. 2% of what?
2% of national defense spending. I think people need to take a kind of a broader look at this, too. I mean, the French, for example, have been, you know, the sharp end of the spear combating terrorism in North Africa. In Mali, for example, they've been taking the lead to the extent that the United States or others have been engaged. It's been in support of them, providing them different types of refueling or other types of support. The Germans have been playing a very forward-leaning role in Afghanistan and in Iraq and now in northeast Syria. We get tremendous benefits from NATO. And I think that the point that Frank made before the last commercial on the economic benefits of stability is a really important one. It makes sense for the expenditures to be shared more fairly. But if the timeline for that is 2024, then we just got to make sure that they are on track to meet that on that timeline.
And as Matthew's pointing out, they are spending more. In fact, this discussion and this move to spend more well predates the election of President Trump, and they are spending more. And President Trump, of course, as he's wont to do, is taking full credit for all of that.
Dominique wrote on our Facebook page, "As Europeans, we are not too enthusiastic about getting involved under NATO in what we believe are U.S.-escalated conflicts and are U.S.-led afterwards, and with the U.S. showing to be capable of abandoning the fight." Matt, what about that?
So there's two different points there. One is there are some people in Europe who really feel that increasingly NATO is being asked to get involved in fights that are of an American creation. The invasion of Iraq, the very long deployment to Afghanistan, that's one conversation. And I'd argue that what NATO provides is a way for the Europeans to have a larger say in these types of matters, and certainly a say in how those things are dealt with and the deployments are dealt with. And the second half of that, I'm sorry, I missed the...
In terms of U.S. escalated conflicts, U.S. led afterwards, and with the U.S. showing to be capable of abandoning the fight.
Right, sorry. And the second part is whether the U.S. has the commitment to stick to these things, whether, especially now, if you look at Northeast Syria, first just about a year ago in December, and now just a few weeks ago, the president twice now, suddenly, without informing his own Pentagon, let alone his European or NATO allies, that he was simply going to turn on a dime and leave. And Europeans and others are afraid that they're going to get stuck carrying the can. They're also worried about how are they supposed to budget out? How are they supposed to decide on deployments months or years out when they aren't convinced that we will stick to this? And we talked briefly before about the counter-ISIS ministerial meeting that was held 2 weeks ago here in Washington, D.C. This was a major point that European and Arab members of the counter-ISIS coalition made in terms of their concerns about the U.S. being able to stick to it.
Frank, let's talk about that terror attack over the weekend. Mm-hmm. What more do we know about the attacker himself? Have we learned anything?
Well, what we've learned is that it's a remarkable story, Joshua. He had been, as we understand it, a part of this Cambridge prisoner rehabilitation program in which Cambridge University students were studying in prisons, working with prisoners to help rehabilitate them. And he ended up coming to this conference, which is a building right on the edge of London Bridge, and ended up killing two students from Cambridge University who were there helping to run the program about this rehabilitation program. He also was an acolyte of a man named Anjem Chowdhury, who is described here, and very much so, fairly, as an Islamic hate preacher. And he's done a lot of time in prison. And even when they put him in prison, they were concerned about the influences that he would have. And clearly, he's had a big influence. And this this attacker, who seemed to have been reformed, seems not to have been reformed at all, and perhaps was planning this all along.
What's the reaction been like from officials there, particularly from London's mayor, Sadiq Khan? There was another terror attack on London Bridge 2 years ago. President Trump criticized Mayor Khan in the wake of that attack. What's the response been like so far to this?
Well, I think what Mayor Khan, it's interesting, what Mayor Khan has said, he's really praised, as President Trump did today as well, these ordinary citizens, ordinary residents who were in the building at the time of the attack, who actually counterattacked and went after this man, Usman Khan, chased him out onto London Bridge. I assume many of the listeners right now have actually seen the videos. It's extraordinary. They were the ones who caught him, not the police. The police came in and did shoot him in the end. But I think that when you hear mayors like Sadiq Khan talking about being defiant in the face of terrorism, these were ordinary folks who were truly defiant in the face of terrorism. And I think this is I've been here for a little over 3 years, and this is the fifth attack that I've covered in London. And it's very clear that if people are really trying to terrorize the city, they're not succeeding.
But they must take a toll on Londoners at a certain point, Frank, right?
I don't know. I mean, it's been a lull for 2 years. The first London Bridge attacks were really bad. There were far more fatalities and far more injuries. And that was on a Saturday night, as I recall, and it was in Borough Market where there are lots of restaurants. But, you know, honestly, Joshua, I don't feel that way. I think that when you talk to people, they are sorrowful for what happened. They are horrified. But as they will often say, they went through the bombings of the IRA, they went through the bombings of the Blitz, and I don't get a sense that these attacks are materially affecting the way people go about their lives every day in the city.
Matt, let's talk about the attacker a little bit more. Frank mentioned that he was part of a prisoner reentry program in the UK. Some have described this attacker as a lone wolf, as someone who was kind of radicalized online but was not formally officially a member of any known terror cell or terror organization. Is there anything about the case of this man that is indicative of larger trends, larger issues in the fight on terror, either in Europe or elsewhere? Or is he kind of a unique case?
So this is a really interesting case that highlights a whole bunch of important trends and concerns. And this answers the question that someone called in earlier asking, you know, this is a local news issue. Why is it being sensationalized?
Let me read that comment one more time. It was from Jordan, who wrote on our Facebook page, "How is two people getting killed anything more than a local news story? This is being sensationalized."
So there are a lot of issues to unpack here. One is the fact that certainly in Europe, where there tend to be shorter prison sentences, but even here in the United States, the vast majority of people who even commit really heinous crimes are eventually going to be released from prison. And the question is what happens to them afterwards? And are our traditional parole systems sufficient for people who were in part motivated to carry out an act of violence, to be mobilized to violence based on radical ideologies? And so because of that, both in the United States and in Europe, here in the UK, in this case, these programs both in the prisons and for post-release have been sprouting up to kind of rehabilitate and facilitate the reentry of these released prisoners into society. That's not being soft on terrorism. That's just recognizing that under the law, people are going to be released. Now, this case is interesting because there was something in the UK called imprisonment for public protection, where you could basically hold someone in prison for a much longer indeterminate period of time. It actually came into force under a Labour government and then was knocked down under a Conservative government in 2012. But that only happened after Usman Khan was sentenced early in 2012 for participating in a terrorist cell, plotting stuff both in the UK and to go travel to Pakistan to put together a training camp regarding the conflict in Kashmir.
Usman Khan, the attacker from this past weekend.
Exactly. And so he does have a history here. This is not a lone offender in that sense. He might have carried out this on his own. In 2013, he and a few other people appealed and successfully won an appeal against their imprisonment for public protection sentence. And the resentence was 16 years, which you traditionally do serve about half of that time in the UK system. Now, here's what's interesting. Under the UK system, what should have happened is that a parole board would have reviewed his case to determine whether he was sufficiently rehabilitated to be able to be released halfway through the sentence. But apparently that didn't happen at all. Just about halfway through the sentence, he was released on what they call a license. And one of the things that is being discussed now is, okay, we got to go back and look, what's the parole board's role? What is it doing? What is it not?
So license is kind of like a parole.
Exactly. And it's almost automatic once you've served a certain amount of your sentence. There are other things that are interesting here, not just the issue that many more people are going to be coming out of prison, people who were sentenced for terrorism-related crimes related to al-Qaeda in the years after 9/11, some people sentenced to shorter terms because, for example, including here in the United States, where they plotted to travel to the Islamic State, but they didn't go, so their sentences are shorter. We're going to have more people coming out of prison that we're going to have to deal with. It also fits into this conversation between President Trump and President Macron on the issue of foreign terrorist fighters. There's a tremendous concern in Europe, certainly among the public, but among politicians, therefore, as well. What happens as these people come home? Do we have the evidence to put them in jail? Even if we do, how long will they serve in their sentences? And then what happens to them afterwards? And this is a generational question.
You can't just lock them up and throw away the key. Or if we could, but more realistically, that seems like a far-fetched thing to presume.
Exactly.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. With regard to the cultural impact of this, Frank, I'd like you to respond to Marie, who tweeted, "Well, this is one of the reasons for Brexit. Britain is the final destination point for most immigrants. A small island can't sustain that influx of people, and the cultures coming are not immersing." Frank?
That's interesting. Usman Khan was born and raised in England, and as far as we know, was radicalized here. So that doesn't, he's a homegrown terrorist. Some of the people who actually, you know, did citizens arrest on London Bridge, at least one of them, was a Polish chef. So, in fact, it was interesting. It was an immigrant who felt that he had a civic duty to protect strangers, people he didn't know, in London. And it was a homegrown person who was the one who pulled the knives out and attacked the students at this event. So I understand the nature of the question, but the facts don't really fit the question.
I do also understand the point Marie's making in terms of an influx of people. Immigration into Western Europe was one of the big issues for Brexit. Opponents of the Brexiteers would say that that was just kind of a veiled way of saying that Britain has too many brown people.
And I think that it's more, it's a cultural issue. It's a nationalistic issue here. There's a lot of nostalgia among many white Britons, who are the vast majority of the country, to an earlier era. But it was not about crime. I think the opposition to migration, I mean, immigrants here are not big criminal. They don't participate any more, I think, in criminal activity than others. Right. It was really more of a cultural issue. And in a number of the terrorism attacks that I've covered, it was people from this country.
And Matt, this must have an impact, this mentality, in terms of the way that we fight terrorism. I mean, there have been efforts in parts of London and Paris and Berlin and elsewhere to try to connect with immigrant communities, especially communities of immigrants who are Muslim, and try to build bridges, to try to open opportunities for people who see something to say something. Those have had mixed success, but it seems like the fight against terror in many ways is not just a counterintelligence fight, it's a cross-cultural fight.
That's exactly right. You know, I give Europeans and the Brits a lot of credit for trying and failing in this regard. Here in the United States, we don't have a culture of trying and failing. You go to your politicians with an idea, they want you to show that it's proven to succeed first. And what I'm talking about here is the UK's counterterrorism policy is called CONTEST, and it has four components to it, conveniently all starting with the letter P: prevent, pursue, protect, and prepare. The biggest bang for our buck is always going to be earliest in the process, the prevent, trying to do things to build resilient communities, trying to do things to make sure that people feel comfortable in their communities, they can access government services, they can get into school, they can get jobs. Then if that fails, you have the pursue, protect, and prepare. And I think that the big question here is not so much whether these rehabilitation programs are useful. In the UK, they have great programs like this for people who've come out of prison. They have great programs, actually, for people in prison. They have great programs for people who have not yet committed a crime, trying to prevent them from getting to that point. The real question here is whether Usman Khan gained the system. He said all the right things. He went on the BBC and said, "Everybody knows me. I was born here. I'm not a terrorist." He participated in these programs, and one of the things the services I'm sure are looking into right now is how long was this being planned? Was this a sudden snap? Some people are speculating that because his family is originally from the Kashmir region and his original crime for which he served prison, he was planning to go and fight in Kashmir and then maybe come back to the UK. Was it because India, there have been some crackdowns in Kashmir and they've revoked some administrative rule there. Does that have anything to do with it? Was it to go even farther back than that? Mm. The vetting process for these programs, I think, is going to be a real question moving forward.
Before we go, Frank, what's next in the NATO summit? What else should we be looking out for?
Well, I think tomorrow the big thing will be President Trump in the afternoon giving a press conference. And I think that people will be wanting to hear how supportive he is of NATO. You know, former National Security Advisor John Bolton said it apparently in a private, was reported to say in a private speech that he thought that President Trump might try to pull out of NATO if he wins a second term. So people will be watching Trump very closely to see how much support he offers to this military alliance.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, thanks for talking to us.
Happy to do it, Joshua.
And Matt Levitt, a senior fellow and director at the Reinhard Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you, Matt.
A pleasure.
Coming up, you might have heard that catastrophic wildfires in Australia have made koalas a functionally extinct species. The truth's a little more complicated. Stay close.